Okay, so the idea was to try to dig a little bit deeper into the notion of null geodesics and what, realizes them physically. And before I come back to that, I'll just describe what might be a mathematical approach to null geodesics, just to, get a sense of the distinction between the physics underpinning versus just the mathematical expressions. So we derived an equation for time-like geodesics based on the variational principle. So that was a nice, feature of the geometry of this, where we say, okay, here are two points in space-time, and let's find a curve that maximizes proper time between those two points, and that gave us the geodesic equation. And before we specialized it to proper time parameterization, the statement of the geodesic equation was that, okay, so we have a vector field T that is going to be tangent to the curve, and then we have the geodesic equation that's written as the rate of change of the vector field along the curve parameterized by lambda being proportional to the vector field itself. So that was the generalized form of the geodesic equation, and the intent here was that, well, because we were specializing to time-like geodesics, the idea is that what we would do is to specify an initial value for the vector field here and make sure that the inner product of that vector field with itself, that the norm of the vector field was negative, that defines a time-like vector field. And then we would find a time-like vector field everywhere along that curve by solving the differential equation. And having started with a time-like vector field, the equation guarantees that the vector field will stay time-like the whole time. So that was the initial context and the content of the variational principle. And then, but what we can do to define null geodesics was to say, well, would be to say, well, we don't have a variational principle for that, because what we're trying to extremize to define time-like geodesics, namely proper time, would be zero on a null geodesic. So that doesn't give us a means to find a variational principle strictly for null geodesics, but we can always take null geodesics to be a special limiting case of this. So to go from time-like to null, all we would have to do is to say, okay, we're going to be solving exactly the same differential equation, because that's what defines a geodesic. It's going to be the differential equation, except that now we allow ourselves to enlarge the space of solution by starting with an initial value for the vector field that is actually a null vector. And that would change the nature of the problem. We start with a null vector field, but we're still solving the same differential equation. And the differential equation would guarantee that the vector would stay null along the evolution. So that would be an approach, mathematical approach to null geodesics, that would just say, well, consider that to be a limiting special case of time-like geodesics. And you could approach it also from a space-like direction, it doesn't matter. And if we think of this very simply in terms of, geodesics in flat space, well, if this is time, this is x, well, a time-like geodesics would be described by x equals v times t. So we would have a time-like geodesic that looks like this, but then we could consider a sequence of those and let v approach the speed of light, and then we would have a whole sequence that brings us gradually as a limiting case to a null geodesic like that. So it's basically that same idea, but here I'm formulating it a bit more generally in terms of solving differential equations in a curved space-time. So that's all fine and good, and there's nothing wrong with this, but it's defining the geodesics, the null geodesics, in a mathematical way. Nothing wrong with that, but it's nice to think about what would be a physical underpinning of this, and that's what I wanted to talk about. So one small remark before we move on from here. Here I'm starting with a non-affine parameterization of my time-like geodesics and taking a limit with that same parameterization. If I started out with proper time parameterization, I would run into a lot of trouble, because proper time goes singular on a null geodesic. If I parameterize it with proper time, when I take the null limit, proper time becomes identically, well, constant, It doesn't change on an L-geodesic, so parameterizing the time-like geodesic in terms of proper time would really prevent us from taking a null limit. So that's why you have to start with a more, more generalized formulation where the parameter is not affine. Then the limit doesn't present any obstacle. And at that stage, you can always reparameterize the null geodesic to an affine parameterization that allows you to kill the right-hand side. I'm not going to go into those details here, but that's just to say that the null version of an affinely parameterized geodesic is not something you can get from a time-like limit. So it just doesn't work because, proper time doesn't change on an L-geodesic, so it would be very, very ill-advised to use proper time as a parameterization of null geodesics, of time-like geodesics, and then try to take a limit. Okay, so that's the mathematical way of approaching it, and as I said, there's nothing wrong with this, but the idea would be to understand physically what realizes the null geodesics in physics, and that's where I want to go back to basic ideas, where presumably we want to describe the path of light. And if we're going to be talking about light in the physical terms, we have to introduce an electric field, we have to introduce a magnetic field, and we have to describe configurations of electromagnetic fields that do correspond to, light, namely electromagnetic waves. So it's not all configurations, as I said this morning, of electromagnetic fields that will correspond to anything traveling with the speed of light. But if we look for those kinds of configurations, then we have a physical underpinning behind the propagation of light in a curved spacetime or in a flat spacetime. So I just want to start from, very basic physics considerations, so things that you've probably, thought about, at some point during your undergraduate education. So what is light? Well, as I said, light is is something that corresponds to a configuration of electromagnetic field. And now I want to be more specific about this. So if we're going to be talking about a configuration of electromagnetic magnetic field that describes light, we have to talk about something rather specific. That something specific is something that will behave like this. So I'm going to write it as a complex, a complex expression like this, and I'm going to distinguish the amplitude of the field versus the phase of the field. And any field can be written like this, but what distinguishes a field configuration that describes traveling light as opposed to, a static Coulomb field or something like that, is a situation where the phase varies rapidly, whereas the amplitude varies slowly. And what I would argue and what happens, so when you're describing a situation where the electromagnetic field describes a wave, we're really talking about situations where you can split the field into an amplitude and a phase and be dealing with a situation where the phase is something that varies rapidly compared with the amplitude. And that, when you have those conditions, you have something that looks like an electromagnetic wave, and therefore you have something that looks like light. So let me draw a picture that I hope will illustrate what I'm trying to describe here. So the key idea here is that we have, a phase that we can define for our electromagnetic wave. And, given that we have a phase function, we have a notion of phase fronts that will be, that will be unfolding in some way in some space. So here I'm thinking of some kind of, familiar situation where you might have some kind of, medium, characterized by a refraction index, and you would have an electromagnetic wave traveling through that. So what we would have are a bunch of phase fronts. So I'm going to draw a whole bunch of them. So by phase front, I just mean a surface of constant phase. So here's S equals zero. And then next to it, we would have another phase front corresponding to, say, S equals pi. And then right next to it, we would have another face front corresponding to s equals 2 pi. And then I'll stop labeling them because I can't fit all this writing. But the point here is that all the face fronts, I'm describing them as very close to one another. And that gives a sense that as we move in the direction in which the phase is increasing, the scale of variation of that phase is actually very small. So that's what I mean by a phase that varies rapidly. I don't have to move very much in space in order to see a large variation of the phase. So if I'm drawing this pictorially, that's what I would see, a whole stack of phase fronts that are very, very tightly packed together. So that's the idea. And on the other hand, while I see that my phase front is not necessarily flat, it doesn't have to be flat if I have some kind of refractive medium in which the light is propagating through. So the phase fronts can vary, but that scale of variation where we see a modulation of the phase front, well, that's the long variation that we're talking about. And that's the one that's also associated with the variation in amplitude. So in a situation like this, we have, in mathematical terms, we have something like this. But the idea here is that we have a very small scale of variation going from one phase front to the next, whereas over here we have a very long variation, either of, a long variation across the phase fronts that would be also associated with a long variation of the amplitude that's also involved in the description of the E and B fields. No. So it certainly means that the field has gone through a complete oscillation. So the field itself sort of recovers more or less, apart from variations in amplitude, the same configuration. But we do see a progression in phase. So the phase keeps on going monotonically, in this mathematical description. So it's not quite the same because the amplitude changes slowly over, the complete cycle of the phase. So, so the key idea is that we have very closely packed phase fronts like this and a long scale variation of the amplitude. So that's the kind of field configuration that corresponds to light. What are the light rays? Well, if you go back to your description of physical optics in your undergraduate lecture, the light rays are going to be the lines that are orthogonal to the phase fronts. So that would be one of the light rays. This would be another one of the light rays. And they all have the property that they're, the light rays are defined to be those things that are orthogonal to all the phase fronts. So that's how we define light rays. And if we want to describe those light rays mathematically, well, basically it's attached to the behavior of the phase fronts. And you take the gradient of a surface S equal constant that gives you the orthogonal directions. And that's going to be the direction of the light rays in physical space. So the point is that light rays are defined in terms of specific field configurations. And once you have those kinds of, configurations, then you can define the light rays as being the lines that are orthogonal to each surface S equal constant. So that's how we think of light rays in more physical terms. And if we wanted to realize a light ray physically, namely build a light beam, out of some kind of optical apparatus, well, what we would do is to look at a small region like this. So we would look at all the light rays that are close together like this in some region of space. And what we would do to generate a light beam in a lab would be to collimate that field configuration. So we would, we would make it go through a hole or something like that. And then probably we would put some optical elements in front to make sure that the beam doesn't diverge too fast. But the essential idea is that, globally, we would have all of those light rays defined in terms of the lines that are orthogonal to phase fronts. But if we want to define a light beam, we would basically get rid of most of this. We would make that go through a hole. So we would, absorb all of that stuff over here we would absorb all of that stuff over here. What remains is what goes through that hole, and what goes through that hole is basically just a local version of what we've constructed more globally, and that's the light beam. And the light beam is just a collection of light rays, and depending on what happens to your index of refraction, that light beam might stay parallel to itself, or it might converge, or it might diverge. It might do all of those things, but you know, that becomes a property of the underlying medium. The light rays themselves just follow whatever path is dictated by, you know, Fermat's theorem and all of that stuff. So bottom line here is that light rays are not abstract mathematical things. They're things you can build in physics labs, and they correspond to field configurations that have that kind of structure where you have a rapidly varying phase combined with a slowly varying amplitude. And it's only under those conditions that you can, you know, really say that you're dealing with a configuration of electromagnetic field that will give you something that looks like propagating light. So that's true for light propagating through a medium, and it's true for light propagating through a curved spacetime in, you know, sort of analogous terms. You know, the spacetime curvature plays the role of a refractive index, loosely speaking. But the idea is that, well, if you want to have light rays in a curved spacetime, you have to arrange for field configurations that satisfy this sort of property here. So that's how we're going to be thinking about this, and we're going to see that, well, if you have that, and if you have Maxwell's equations, then sure enough, the null version of the geodesic equation comes out as a consequence of the physical theory behind it. It doesn't come out just in terms of, you know, a mathematical limit of time-like curves. It really comes out as a physical consequence of Maxwell's equations. Okay, so that's going to be my picture of what light is, and I want to explore those ideas. And part of it is going to be to sort of bring out the physics, hopefully a bit more clearly than I just did. So we'll bring out the physics in full, but also I'll take an opportunity to introduce some geometric techniques that will be required when we describe null geodesics, and, you know, not just one, but a whole system, namely a whole congruence of those things. Okay, so let me go into this a little bit more deeply by looking at a very specific example. I think will illustrate the ideas much more concretely. So I'm not going to look at Maxwell's equations for the time being. We'll do something a little bit more schematic. And I'm going to be talking about a field configuration corresponding to a scalar field. And I'm going to look at the dipole solution to the field equation. So let's look at this. So I'm talking about a scalar field, call it phi. And it's going to be a massless scalar field that will satisfy this equation here, the wave equation, in flat spacetime. So we're going to do something very, very simple to make sure that the ideas are understood. So flat spacetime, I'm going to be working in spherical coordinates. So the metric here will be written in this form. And the dipole solution I'm thinking about, I'm going to write it like this. So there's going to be a factor of 1 over r. I could multiply this by a constant, but that constant would turn out to be irrelevant or not interesting, so I won't put it on. So that's I divided by omega r. Omega is going to be the field frequency. That multiplies a cosine theta that tells me that that field is in a dipole configuration. And this multiplies the phase, and the phase is just going to be minus I omega t minus r. So that's my field configuration. I'm using a scalar field as something a little bit simpler to deal with than the full electromagnetic field. But, you know, there's a very close analogy between this and Maxwell's equations when we're describing wave-type solutions. So this whole thing here is the amplitude. And I'm going to call it A. And this whole thing here is the phase. So I'm going to call that S. And I'm going to think of omega. Well, omega would be the frequency of the field. I'm going to think of this as a large number, so that I see something here oscillating very rapidly, whereas the amplitude in front, well, that will become a very small correction that I won't, you know, care about. But the scale of variation of the amplitude is going to be much longer than the very rapid variation associated with the phase. So with omega being thought as being large in some sense, we have this situation that I was describing before, where the amplitude varies slowly, whereas the phase varies very rapidly. And that will give us a notion of, well, not light rays in this case, but the scalar field analog of that. Okay, so I hope this is clear. So just to illustrate the rapid variation of the phase, so I'm going to consider a change in spatial position corresponding to a wavelength. So we're going to move in the radial direction by one wavelength, and the wavelength here is simply going to be 2 pi over omega. So I'm keeping a t constant here, so it's a purely spatial displacement. And if I calculate the change in phase corresponding to this, well, that's a constant, so we don't have to worry about it. So we're changing r by 2 pi over the wavelength, over the frequency. So we're changing the phase by 2 pi, which means that we're generating a full cycle of the phase. And that means that that small displacement by a wavelength has produced a very large change in phase. So that change by 2 pi, because it changes the field configuration by a whole cycle, that's a large variation. Whereas if I look at the corresponding change in amplitude, well, we're going to see that that's going to be a rather small change. So if I calculate the change in amplitude, I'll focus on the 1 over r term here. This is just a small correction. We won't need to worry about it. So if I change r, I change the amplitude by a factor of dr over r squared. Never mind the cosine, never mind the minus sign that comes from taking the derivative. We don't need to worry about this. If I calculate the fractional rate, fractional change in amplitude, I'm multiplying by r what I just computed here. So what do I get? I get lambda over r. And if I'm dealing, if I'm looking at the field configuration in a wave zone, r is guaranteed to be much larger than lambda, then that's guaranteed to be a very small change. So if we're r in the wave zone, then delta A over A is extremely small. And we have that situation I was describing before where, a small displacement produces a large change in phase, but a very tiny change in amplitude. And that's where the notion of light rays, or, the scalar equivalent here, emerges. It's not something that's given to us unless we assemble the right conditions. So it's an emerging phenomenon given the conditions that are specified here. All right. So that's how we're thinking about this, and now we can provide a bit more mathematical details to this. Because I would like to define the light rays, I would like to define the surfaces of constant phase and all of this, and just, start building up the mathematical formalism that comes with this. So let's get into it. So we have the phase. And the phase is given to us by omega t minus r. And remember the discussion we had before. We're looking at the things that are orthogonal to the phase fronts. But that was a notion that came from a Newtonian picture where we were taking a snapshot at a t equal constant moment. Here I want to give a space-time description of this. So the next best thing will be to talk about the phase fronts and define the normal vector as a vector in space-time. So I'm going to define our vector k, which I promise will be a null vector and will satisfy the geodesic equation, as the gradient of the phase function. So it's going to be normal in a space-time sense to the surfaces of constant phase. So that I will define to be minus the gradient of, and we're working in flat space time, so, but we're working in, you know, in spherical coordinates, so at some point we'll need to take covariant derivatives and be careful about this. I'm going to say that this is the gradient of S divided by omega. I'm just going to rescale my phase to get rid of the factor of omega that will make my vectors a little bit simpler. But that rescaling, you know, really is of no consequence. I could choose not to do this here. I would just be defining a vector with a slightly different factor in front. So that is my definition for the vector k. And I say that, well, because I'm taking the, you know, the vector to point in the direction in which the phase changes, that's going to be normal to the phase fronts S equal constant. So we've talked about hypersurfaces before. We introduced the notion that the normal vector to a hypersurface can always be given by the gradient of the equation defining the hypersurface. So we're doing exactly the same thing here. So that's the definition. And this vector will satisfy, you know, very nice properties for us, including the fact that it's null, that it satisfies the geodesic equation, and it will give us more stuff on top of that. So if we calculate it, that vector is given by the gradient of t minus r. So that's what we get after dividing through by omega. So if I write down the components, in the order tr theta phi, I'm going to get a non-zero component along t, a non-zero component along r, and then zero components along theta and phi. So in spherical coordinates, where I'm listing in order of t, r, theta, phi, those are the components of the null vector with the indices down. So that's my vector with the indices down. And if I raise the index using the metric, I'm going to turn this minus 1 into a plus 1. I'm going to take this one into a plus 1, and the zeros will be exactly the same. So that's the null covector defined to be the normal to the phase fronts. This is the vector that, you know, comes with it by raising the index. And you can quickly see that if I take the scalar product of k with itself, we're getting a null vector. So that vector k, normal to the phase fronts, working with that field configuration, is a null vector. And I'm going to draw some diagrams in a moment just to illustrate what's happening here. Okay, so that's one fact that we're getting here. And along with this, we also have the fact that this k vector satisfies the geodesic equation in a fine parameter form. So let's verify this. So what I want to do is to calculate the gradient of the k vector in the direction of k itself. And if I get that the result is zero, then that's the statement that k satisfies the geodesic equation. And that's going to be an instance where k, a null vector, is also a geodesic vector field. So we can just do the computation. And the key aspect here is that k is defined as a gradient. And that will guarantee, together with the fact that it's a null vector, it will guarantee that property that it satisfies the geodesic equation. So let's do the computation. So I'm going to incorporate the fact that this is a gradient. So we have the covariant derivative of a gradient. So I can rewrite it in this form right here, where we have two covariant derivatives acting on the gradient. That's a scalar. I can always flip the order of differentiation here. So I'm going to write it as the same covariant derivatives, but now expressed in the opposite order. And because it's a scalar, there is no curvature term that would arise because of that flip. So it's exactly the same. But now what do I have? I'm going to get rid of that minus sign, because I have k beta times the alpha derivative of k beta. So here I'm isolating that derivative, and what remains is the beta derivative of this, which apart from this minus sign gives me back the vector k. So I have k beta grad alpha k beta, and you'll remember that calculation that we did before, that's exactly the same thing as the alpha derivative of the product of k beta with itself. And because this is zero everywhere, the gradient of zero is zero, so we get zero. So this vector field that we define to be orthogonal to the surfaces of, or normal to the surfaces of constant phase, is not only null, but it also satisfies the traditional form of the geodesic equation. So it's defining for us null geodesics. So that's the idea that I wanted to pursue here, that we're using a physical field, namely a scalar field here, as an analogy or, you know, as a toy model for a full electromagnetic field. But we're letting the field define the thing for us that's going to satisfy the geodesic equation, and therefore we are letting the field define for us what light rays are. So let me just, you know, put some pictures behind this, because I think those ideas are very important. And we're going to be, you know, pursuing that in the full discussion. So let's describe the geodesics. So the geodesics, well, we know what the vector is. So we know that the geodesics are going to be the integral curves of that vector field. So we're, so, you know, we're looking to solve that differential equation, where the k vector is actually a nice simple constant vector field. So that's going to be very simple to solve. So that unraveled, that means that dt d lambda is going to be 1, dr d lambda is going to be 1, and d theta d lambda is going to be 0, and d phi d lambda is going to be 0. So even I can find solutions to those differential equations. We get that t is going to be lambda plus a constant. R is going to be lambda plus a constant. And then theta is going to be a constant. And phi is going to be equal to our constant. Those are the geodesics. Those are the light rays that the field is giving us. So we have that, and we also have, well, the phase fronts. S over omega, let's rescale it as we did before, that's going to be T minus R, and the phase fronts are going to be surfaces S equal constant. So with those equations, I think we can, you know, get a pretty complete, you know, space-time picture of what's going on. The phase fronts are going to be light cones, and the geodesics are going to be tangent curves on those light cones. So let me draw what I mean here. So I'm going to be constructing a space-time diagram where t is going to run upward like this, and then we're going to have the spatial directions here. And so if I'm describing a surface S equal constant, well, I'm describing a surface where t is equal to r plus a constant. So I don't think it takes too much figuring out to see that this will give us a light cone that's going to be shaped like this. So this would be a surface, say, S equals 1. And then, you know, if S is equal to some other value like 2, we're going to have another light cone that's going to be displaced upward from the first one. So we're going to have a second light cone defined on top here. And then for any value of S, we have one of those. So we have a continuous, you know, stack of those light cones, and those are, you know, the space-time picture of what a phase front is according to, you know, to this theory here. So that's the picture of the light fronts, or the phase fronts, and if I draw one of those and picture what the light rays look like, or what the geodesics look like, well, they're still curves t equals r plus a constant. So it's basically exactly the same thing, except that now I have one curve for each value of theta and phi. So if I draw those curves, they're going to look like this. So that would be one of the light rays, that's going to be another one of the light rays. We're going to have a whole bunch of them, you know, wrapping around the light cone like this. So those are going to be the light rays, or the null geodesics that that the field has defined for us. And they're basically spanning each one of those light cones. So for each one of those light cones, I'm going to have a whole set of light rays that go with it. So those are the light rays, and you know, they move with, you know, t equals r plus a constant, and then they move with constant values of the two angles. So with one you know, one dimension suppressed here, that's what they look like. So what we have here is a very nice geometric construction where we have a whole bunch of hypersurfaces, which are null, and each hypersurface being sort of spanned by a whole collection of null geodesics that just go around the null cone like this. And for us, those are the null rays. Those are the things that will be physically realized as light rays. Well, the scalar analog always, but you know, that's the idea, that the light rays that we normally talk about are going to be precisely those geodesics that come from the gradient field that's given to us from the phase. All right. And together with that, we have a whole bunch of, you know, nice little mathematical facts. So we have that K alpha, well, that's the normal to a phase front. And we have that K alpha, well, K alpha is tangent to each null geodesic. So the vector A, K here is the one that points tangent to each one of those null geodesics. And we have this interesting situation that the null hypersurface has a vector that is both tangent to it and normal to it. So that's the beautiful thing that happens when you're dealing with a null vector with a, you know, with a zero scalar product. You can have a vector that's at once normal to a surface and also tangent to the surface. So with those two statements come with the fact that each null geodesic is tangent to the surface, right? So they really hug the surface like this, and each phase front like this comes with its own set of null geodesics like this. And obviously those null geodesics are tangent to the surface. And because K is tangent to that, K is at once tangent and normal. So K alpha is normal and tangent to the null hypersurface, which is, you know, a strange thing for a vector field to do, but it's precisely what it does when the hypersurface is null and when the null when the hypersurface is spanned like this by a whole bunch of null geodesics. So typically we call these things the generator of the hypersurface, but I don't think I'll use that terminology right now. We'll use it later. Right now, I'll just think of these things as scalar analogs to light rays. So that's how we define light rays in GR. We start with a field configuration that gives us the physics that we need for light rays, and then we show as a consequence of the field equations that the normal to the wavefront is actually a null vector that satisfies the geodesic equation, and that's how we prove that light rays actually travel on null geodesics. So we don't take it for granted. We just don't say it is. We prove that it is based on the field equations. All right, yep.
So far, you're saying each point that the wavefront is representative of light rays, right? Showing, I'm using the analysis of the scalar field, but the point is that for light, we have vector case, right?
Yep.
Then we have angular
momentum
there. Sure. And how can we make sure that maybe I'm missing something, that still we have these hypersurface of normality there and the rotations would die?
So we're going to do it all. So we're going to do it from Maxwell's equations. So I just wanted to illustrate the basic ideas before I really get going. So this is all a warm-up, but it's going to follow in the same way. We're going to postulate a configuration for the full electromagnetic field that will have a slowly varying amplitude, rapidly varying phase, and that's all we need. After that, we get essentially all of those results all over again, but in a more, general context, and also using Maxwell's theory as opposed to a fake, scalar field theory. Other questions? Okay, so,
Is it that K, it has this property that it's both tangent and normal to the hypersurface, or is it that the direction of normal and the direction tangent is in the same space-time direction?
Yeah, so I think these are equivalent statements, right? So yeah, so K defines a direction in space-time, and that direction happens to be both normal and tangent to the same surface, right? So that's the beautiful paradox of null vectors. They give us that.
That's coming from the wavefronts, right?
It's coming from, here we were relying on the structure of that solution and the fact that, if you want a solution to the scalar field equation, of that specific form, the wavefronts have to have that T minus R, structure. And that, of course, gives us a null surface and it gives us a null vector. And the point is that this is not just an artifact of this very specific solution. That's something that will follow as a result of a full theoretical account built only on the notion that we have a rapidly varying phase and a slowly varying amplitude. All right, so I really insist on this. We have a physical underpinning of what null geodesics are, and in this construction, well, they're guaranteed to be hypersurface orthogonal. So that's, my comment of before where I said that, for time-like geodesics, it was a little bit of a restriction to impose hypersurface orthogonality. Here, it basically comes for free, at least in this, in this framework. Now, it's possible to have vector fields that are, null vector fields that are not hypersurface orthogonal. It's possible to have, null vector fields that don't satisfy the geodesic equation. But what I'm saying is that if you provide this physical underpinning to the null vector field, then you get those properties for free. And the physical underpinning is that structure that we keep talking about. Right. Okay, so before moving on from this example, I want to calculate the gradient of that vector field, because you remember in a time-like case that it was the gradient that told us about the behavior of neighboring geodesics, and I want to see what we're getting in this situation, at least for that specific context.
This whole picture, is it inspired by Huygens principle?
Let me remember what this says. So Huygens principle says that
point on the wavefront can be considered
as a source for, right. It's more general than this, because Huygens principle tends to fail in curved spacetime. But I think in that limit, it might be preserved. Right, so, I don't know the answer to that, but it's an interesting question. Yeah. Okay, so let's calculate something that we'll, again, use as guidance for the full, the fuller picture where we don't rely on a specific solution to the scalar wave equation. I want to calculate the gradient of that vector field that's given to us. And it's a straightforward calculation. I won't go through the details here, but it's very easy given that the vector field is constant, and The only thing that we have to worry about is that we're dealing with a metric. It's the metric of flat space time, but it's written in spherical coordinates, so there will be non-zero Christoffel symbols. But we can do this calculation very simply. I mean, you've done worse. And if I describe the result as a matrix for all the components, you know, in the ordering TR theta phi, TR theta phi, then we get 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. So we get a whole bunch of zeros, and then here we get r, and here we get r sine squared theta. So the only place where the vector gradient doesn't vanish is in the space that's spanned by the angular coordinates. And that's pretty significant, and we're going to have a lot more to say about this. So it's only non-trivial in that corner here of the full matrix. Let's calculate theta. So let's calculate the divergence of that vector field, something that I will later call theta by analogy with what we had in the time length direction. If we calculate this, well, that's the same thing as calculating the trace of that matrix. And remembering that for the inverse metric here, the r squared that we have is converted to a 1 over r squared. So if we do that calculation, we're going to get 1 over r squared multiplying r plus 1 over r squared sine theta squared multiplying r sine squared theta. So that's just doing this operation here where I'm tracing over those terms, but I'm involving the inverse metric in the computation. We get stuff canceling out, and we get 2 over r. And that's kind of interesting. It's even more interesting if I write it in the form 1 over 4 pi r squared times the lambda derivative of 4 pi r squared. So here I'm rewriting it in a way that I think is very suggestive. That's the area of a sphere of constant r. I'm taking a lambda derivative, but you know, on those curves, lambda and r are the same up to a constant, so taking a lambda derivative is the same as taking an r derivative. So I'm converting r squared into 2r, dividing by r squared, that gives me 2r. But written this way, I'm learning something pretty important. I'm learning that this divergence of the null vector field is related to a fractional change of area. So in the time-like case, we had fractional changes in volume. Here we seem to have the fractional change in area coming out. And what do I mean by areas? Well, if I'm talking about those null cones over here, I'm talking about taking a cross-section of that null cone, namely a cross of lambda equal constant, a cross-section defined by lambda equal constant, which means r equal constant, and seeing what happens to that cross-section as r or lambda increases. And what we see, of course, is that as we follow the light rays on the null cone, the area is increasing in size. And the area is increasing in size in a way that's precisely defined or calculated, accounted for by that calculation there. So what does it all mean? Well, it means that this quantity over here is measuring along the null cones, along the light rays, the fractional change in cross-sectional area. And that turns out that this quantity here, you know, even in a more general setting, you know, when we go away from that very specific situation, will preserve that interpretation. And the key part here is that, you know, in the case of time-like congruences, we were, you know, using the divergence of the vector field as a measure of fractional changes in volume as we follow the congruence. Here we have a congruence of light rays, and as we follow the congruence of light rays, we have not a change in volume, but a change in cross-sectional area. And that's a rather, you know, dramatic change that we get here that's given to us because of the null nature of the vector field. So that's something very dramatic that happens as we go from time-like to null. We're changing volumes into areas. And it turns out there's a very, you know, deep reason behind this and something that we can put our finger on. And I'll just do that in a second. That property here is associated with the fact that that gradient vector here, the vector gradient that we just computed here, has components only in theta and phi. All the zeros mean that when we take the trace over here, we have no contributions from any other direction except for the angular directions. So there's something about the fact that this matrix breaks down into a 2x2 subblock with a bunch of zeros that tells us that, you know, what this measures here is, you know, a property of that two-dimensional space that we see emerging here. And that two-dimensional space is what I'll call the transverse space of the congruence. I used to use this language for the space orthogonal to U in the time-like case, and that space was three-dimensional. In this case, because we're dealing with null geodesics, that space has become two-dimensional, and that reduction in dimension comes with, you know, going from volume to areas. So there's something very, very, you know, important that's happened here geometrically that is very, you know, tied to the fact that we're dealing with null vector fields, and null vector fields, you know, are very subtle, and they bring all of this stuff, you know, with them. All right? So we're exploring the ideas here. We're going to, you know, we're going to develop that, you know, systematically as we go away from that very simple example and do something more systematic based on Maxwell's equation. Okay, so why that reduction in dimension? So why did we get this? Why are we getting that in terms of areas and, you know, and not volumes? Well, let's think about this. And what I'm about to describe here is a very key idea. So please pay attention. So let's compare the, you know, the time-like case versus the null case. Okay, so let's go back to the time-like case. And let's think of a congruence that's hypersurface orthogonal. That's going to be a little bit easier to think about this. So here's one of those hypersurfaces. And here's, you know, the members of the congruence that go through that hypersurface. And because we have hypersurface orthogonality, they all go through like this at right angles. So we have space-time. And we have a preferred time direction that's provided to us by the vector field. And the other remaining directions are, you know, spatial directions, and we have three of them. So the transverse space here that's defined by what's orthogonal to those word lines is 3D. And that's very simple to understand, and, you know, no issue here to worry about. But in the null case, we have something a lot more subtle, because the vector field that we start with, that's guaranteed to be hypersurface orthogonal because it's a gradient to the face fronts. Well, we have a null direction that goes like this. I'm going to draw it like this. I'm not going to try to do too much, you know, 3D drawings here. So I'm saying that we have the direction of the null ray that's, you know, tangent to the vector k. And that null ray, if we follow a displacement along the null ray, well, that's a null direction. And that null direction has the property of defining a zero spacetime measure along itself, right? So if I calculate ds squared along 2 points on that word line, I'm going to get zero because it's a null direction. All right. What we're trying to do here is to define a transverse space to that null direction. And of course, we still have three, you know, directions that are not that direction that's provided here. But the point is that that three-dimensional space is going to be strange in the sense that it really wants to be two-dimensional. So I'm making it more mysterious than it is. So suppose that, so I select this null ray over here. The point is that, you know, having selected one null direction like this, there's always going to be another null direction that's not going to be the same as the previous one, along which ds squared is always zero. So that's a second null direction. And if I measure, you know, any, you know, displacement along that direction, it's still going to give me a nice zero. And that's why we can't have volumes in the space orthogonal to this, because, you know, volumes would be calculated by, you know, for example, picking that direction as one of the orthogonal directions and calculating distances along that line, and that's always going to be zero. So volumes are not defined for that, you know, transverse space in that case, because that transverse space always includes a second null direction along which any, you know, measurement will give you a zero space-like space-time distance. The only thing that remains here are the two directions that are orthogonal to both of these, and that's a two-dimensional space. So after we get rid of that null, second null direction, what remains are two directions, and that's what we're going to call the actual transverse space. We're going to eliminate that second null direction because it really doesn't do anything for us. Volumes are going to be zero because of that. But that, that what remains after eliminating that second null direction is going to be a proper two-dimensional space. And that's why we're getting areas out of that calculation we did before, because that, you know, remaining space is, you know, genuinely two-dimensional. So that's the point. So we define one null direction. What remains, you know, orthogonal to this is going to be a three-dimensional space along which there is always going to be one direction for which ds squared is zero. Therefore, any attempt to calculate a volume of that remaining three-dimensional space will always give you zero, because the volume is always going to be a length along that direction times an area in what remains here. So those volumes are always going to be zero. That's why we get, you know, we don't get a volume scaling over here, but an area scaling, because the stuff that's really important here is what remains after eliminating that null direction, and what remains is a properly two-dimensional space. So it's a little bit tricky to describe, but I think we see hints of that over here, right? So what remains after we take the gradient of the vector field is defined into a 2x2 matrix. So that brings out the two-dimensional nature of the transverse space. And that's also confirmed by this result over here that says that the divergence is measuring a rate of change of not volume, because volumes are, you know, defined to be zero in that orthogonal space. If we properly, you know, eliminate that direction to focus on the purely transverse two-dimensional space that remains, then that divergence will measure how that changes, how the area of that space changes with time. So there's something that happens when we focus on a null direction like this that says that having one null direction, we have to identify another one, and we have to use those two null directions to eliminate a redundant or superfluous third dimension to focus purely on that remaining two-dimensional space. And that's why, you know, we get areas coming out coming out of that divergence calculation. So what makes life a little bit subtle and a little bit harder for null congruences is the fact that if I wanted to project everything, and especially focus on the transverse aspects of the congruence, which tells me how geodesics fly apart, then we have to find a way to project against this, you know, project out of that null direction, but also out of that second null direction. So we have to formalize this by introducing another vector field that's going to be null, but now pointing in that direction instead of that one. All right? So that's where we're going with it. So we're going to introduce a more complete, more complicated projection operation that will allow us to land where we want, which is purely in the transverse space, so that we can, you know, really think of this as a property of the transverse space fully projected, you know, after eliminating the two null directions that we're getting, because we start out with one null direction. Yep.
This it's hard for me to imagine how this expansion is working. Now, I mean, the rate of change in area, in the sense that I think that it's always increasing.
Mm-hmm.
I go along R, increase R.
Yep.
Inevitably, this increases because of the way that we are defining. But then I'm thinking, what if we define in cylindrical coordinates and then say, put the Z and T
mm-hmm.
by the null, and then the pi and rho to be there, I guess, at the disk surface. But over there, if I go along Z, not necessarily with the area of that disk increase, right? Because I'm expecting to under some condition to the area to decrease as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, remember that all of this is tied to that specific solution to the scalar field equation that I wrote down before. And there I made the choice that we're describing outgoing waves. I could have selected an incoming wave solution, and then we would get a decrease in area along the converging null cones as opposed to diverging null cones.
It's very cool coordinate interpretation.
Yeah, it would be T plus R instead of T minus R. And that would describe, you know, not outgoing light cones, but incoming light cones that are converging toward the center as opposed to diverging out to infinity. Right. Yeah, yeah. So everything here is still tied to that specific solution. But yeah, part of the goal here as we generalize this will be to go from this very specific situation to something that's a lot more general. But I think the ideas are, you know, easy to pin down in this simple example. So that's why I'm spending the time to explore it in full. Yep.
I realized that the null vector being orthogonal and or normal and tangent to the hypotenuse is less mysterious than I originally thought, because that's just true of the point of any right cone. If you try to draw one tangent, it's also orthogonal, or also normal at the point of the right cone.
So it's a property of the light cone. Yeah.
It's not even a strange property of a Lorentzian manifold. It's just the fact that the hypersurface has to have its conical.
I can't agree with that. So it very much has to do with Lorentzian manifolds and the fact that we have, the possibility of having null vectors, and so on. So it's really a property.
Necessarily mean anything like about null vectors specifically, just the very fact that you can have a vector that is tangent and normal to a surface. Like, that's not just a property of, not just a special property of a Lorentzian manifold.
I think it is.
Well, I think at the point the surface will not be smooth. And so you can't even have tangent vectors tangent to the vertex of the cone.
Oh, if you're focusing on the vertex, yeah, that's right. So the vector field is not defined at the vertex, right? Yeah. So yeah, everything goes crazy at the center there. Yeah. Okay. So so I still have a bit of time, so let me do a little bit more. So here's the idea, and I think that's really a key idea, and I hope you spend the time to think about this. We have one null direction. The three remaining directions have one other null line associated with it. Distances along that null direction are zero. Therefore, we cannot talk about volumes. All we can do is to talk about areas associated with the remaining two directions that are purely space-like. So that's a very key idea. What we would like to achieve now is a mathematical means to, having selected that null direction, can we find another null direction so that we can project down to a properly two-dimensional space. So we're going back to this idea of decomposing vectors, but now we have more decomposing to do because we want to, of course, introduce that null direction, but we also want to introduce that second one to make sure that we're not introducing directions, remaining directions in space-time that are also associated with a zero increment in proper distance. So that's the idea. So so let me introduce the ingredients to do that. So that's the idea of doing a transverse projection. Okay, so we're given a null vector field. So we're given a null vector K alpha, so that's our starting point. And we know that having selected one null direction in space-time, there's always going to be another one at our disposal, so we're going to pick one of those. So given null vector K, we're going to choose a second null direction, and that's going to be the direction of a second null vector that I'm calling n. So here's the idea, back to the drawing we had before. We have one null direction described by a k vector, and then of all the, you know, three-dimensional directions that are left over after this, we're going to pick one of them to be one of the null directions, and it's going to be, you know, described by a second null vector n. So k is null, so it satisfies the null equation. N has been declared to be null, so it's going to be another null vector like this. And I'm going to impose a condition on N and k. I could leave the scalar product between the two arbitrary, but I'm going to pick the freedom to, you know, to normalize a null vector to impose that extra condition where those two vectors are going to be with a scalar product of minus one. So I can always impose that choice by a rescaling of n. So I can always do that. So those are the defining conditions. And the point here is that we have two conditions on the vector n. We have four vectors to choose from, so we have a lot of solutions. So this is not a unique this doesn't have a unique solution. There are lots of n vectors that will satisfy this property. So the so n is not unique, but that's okay. All we need is one of them. So it doesn't matter which one we pick. If we have a solution, we can use it, no problems. So let me just give you an example of this. So back to the example. In the example we had before, we had the null vector given by 1, 1, 0, 0. And if we want the lowered version of it, it's minus 1, 1, 0, 0. And that was, in the null cone picture, let's call it the TR picture. That was a vector that points in that direction. And for a second null vector, well, all we would have to do is to pick a vector that points in the ingoing null direction as opposed to the outgoing null direction. And the one that satisfies all the conditions here would be, I put a 1/2 in front, and then it's going to be minus 1, minus 1, 0, 0. So I claim that this is a null vector, a thing that can be verified simply from the fact that if we raise the indices here, we're going to get a plus 1 and a minus 1. And then if we multiply and sum over the components, we're going to have minus 1 times 1, that's minus 1, plus minus 1 times minus 1, that's plus 1. So that is a null vector, satisfies the null condition. And then if we multiply with k, we're going to get an overall factor of 1/2, but we're going to get minus 1 here, another minus 1 here. So we get 1 half times minus 2, and that's minus 1. So that's a null direction that satisfies all the requirements. And we might as well pick it because it's nice and simple. And it allows us to take out this null direction, take out this null direction. And what's going to be left over here is something that lives purely in the angular directions theta and phi. So that's the purpose of this, to introduce another null direction so that we can then focus entirely on that cross section, which is purely, you know, in the example we're looking at, in that two-dimensional subblock, spanning the theta and phi directions. So that's one possibility. So that's one of the solutions that we have to those conditions over here. But as I said, that's not a unique solution. We have a vector with 4 components, and we've imposed 2 conditions. So we have 2 more degrees of freedom to play with. So I'm going to give you the general version of that vector. And you can go and verify that it satisfies exactly the same components. So a more general version of that null vector will have 1/2. It's a 2-parameter family. And the parameters are going to be alpha and beta. So along the time direction, we're going to have this. Along the radial direction, we're going to have this. And then along the theta direction, we're going to have alpha over r. And along the phi direction, we're going to have beta divided by r sine theta. So that, I claim, is a vector that satisfies the null condition and satisfies the condition that its inner product with the k vector is minus 1. And this is true for any choice of parameter alpha and beta. So it's a bit awkward here that I've chosen the parameters to be space-time indices. So let's rewrite that. So basically, I can pick my vector as I wish. And I could pick something as general as this, and that would still satisfy all the requirements. But, you know, given a choice, I'd rather go for the simpler one. So I'd rather kill the angular components and just pick, you know, the converging null direction as opposed to the outgoing, you know, expanding null direction as the second null direction in that spacetime. All right, so that's the idea. So what we want to do, and the reason for introducing this this vector here, the second null vector, is that while we're given one null direction, given the face fronts and the gradient of the face front and all of this, so those are the light rays, we pick another null direction to eliminate that second direction where ds squared is 0. And then what remains here is the purely transverse two-dimensional space. And that's where all the action is taking place. So if we want to describe how null geodesics, you know, fly apart in a situation like this, or get to reconverge or get decelerated by the action of gravity, well, all of that action will be taking place in that transverse space. So now the idea is to sort of parallel what we did for the time-like vector field, introduce those vectors as a means to introduce a decomposition of vectors and tensors into all of those directions. And our focus is always going to be on what's happening in the transverse direction, because, again, that's where all the action is taking place. So I'll just get started on this. We'll learn how to decompose a vector. And the next time we'll look into decomposing a general tensor. And after that, we'll specialize to the velocity gradient, you know, grad k, as the thing that encodes all this information about the relative behavior of geodesics. So we basically do for a null congruence what we did for time-like congruences. It's just that, and it's basically the same thing, it's just that now we have more geometrical things to worry about. Namely, we have to, you know, always think of the second null direction and make sure that we take it out before we identify the purely 2D transverse space. Okay. So we're good on that? Yep.
I have a question. Why do we need that
factor of half?
Oh, it's just to make sure that we have this satisfied. So I just want to normalize my n so that the inner product with k is always minus 1. And if I don't insert the right numerical factor here, I still have a null vector, but it's not been normalized properly to enforce this. Why do I want this? It's because it simplifies a lot of the equations that will come next. So it's a convenient choice to make. And it's pretty standard. I think everybody pretty much does that, starting from Penrose and company.
It's fairly conventional, right? Like I've also seen it where they define that scalar product to be minus 2. I've also seen
yeah.
it where they, instead of, you know, factor of 1 and factor of half, instead you have factor 1 on square root 2 on both.
Yeah, yeah. So the normalization of each null vector is arbitrary.
Yeah.
And the relative normalization is something that's also arbitrary and conventional. So you make the choices that you think will simplify your life, and that's the one I like.
Yeah. It looks much more complicated. You say that they are just in opposite direction of each other, right?
Right.
And k is negative 1.
Yeah. No, here it was a simpler choice because obviously it looks simpler, and we also have the spherical symmetry of the situation that tells us, you know, there's no need to point in the angular directions if you can't avoid it. But that was just to make the point that n is not uniquely defined by two conditions, obviously. And the rest of the point is that, well, it doesn't matter. We pick one, and then we work with that. Okay, so let me introduce just a couple of more things. And then we'll call it quits for the day.
So you fix all those degrees of freedom if you start by defining a two-surface.
Yes, that's right. So here I want to define the two-surface after I've made those choices. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we want to define a decomposition of a vector that's now going to work in this null situation. And, let me just write it down because I think it's easier to write down than to say. So we're looking at a decomposition of some arbitrary vector in spacetime. So I'll take that vector to be A, like I did in the time-like case. In the time-like case, there was a component along U and a component along the three orthogonal directions. Here, it's going to be a bit more subtle. There's going to be a component along K. And we still have three orthogonal directions, one of which is going to be N. So we're going to have a term like this along N. And then we're going to have something that's going to be transverse to both k and n. So what's going to be remaining here, what I'm going to call a perp, that's going to be defined to be orthogonal to both k and n. And this will be our choice of transverse space. Given k, choosing n, we have something that's going to be orthogonal to both directions. So a perp is going to be defined to be orthogonal to k and orthogonal to n. So we have a vector that initially starts with four components, one of which is going to be the one along k, another one of which is going to be along n, and then that's going to leave two components in the orthogonal space. So how do we extract each piece? Well, we just take projections. So if I multiply the vector by k alpha, k is a null vector, so I get nothing from the first term. K times n is minus 1, so I'm going to get a2 with a minus sign. So how do we get a2? We just project the vector along k. How do we get a1? We project along n. So that's where we have to be a little bit careful, because A1 is not the component along K. A2 is not the component along N. It's switched over, right? So A1 is the scalar product with N, A2 is the scalar product with K. So again, wonderful properties of null vectors. And then what's left over? Well, what's left over is going to be A perp, and A perp is going to be the difference between A and the other projected pieces. So let me write this so that we remember. So I'm going to put that inside a box along with that. And then A1 alpha is going to be minus NA. And then A2 alpha is going to be minus K alpha. And then, A perp is just going to be the difference between all of those things. So we can work it out, and that will nicely introduce for us a projection operator. So A perp, well, that's going to be the difference between the original vector A minus A1K. So I'm going to write this in full. So it's going to be plus. So it's going to be minus A1K, but A1 is itself minus N multiplying A multiplying K. So that's going to be the A1 term. And then we have minus the A2 term. And A2 is itself minus K times A. So it's going to be another plus K beta, A beta, N alpha. So that's the remaining transverse component. And I'm just going to write it in a slightly more attractive form that will isolate for us the operator that will do the projection onto the transverse piece. And the way to do this will be to factorize a factor of A beta in that expression. So I'm going to rewrite this as a whole bunch of things multiplying A beta. And, you know, I have my A beta here, I have it here. I don't have it here, but I can get it by just using the metric. So there it is. And then what's left over? Well, we have K alpha and beta plus N alpha K beta. And this whole thing here is the thing that does the projection onto the transverse space. So that replaced the P projector that we had in the timeline case, but it achieves the same thing. It kills the two null directions, and what you're left with is a vector that points purely in the two-dimensional transverse space. So conclusion here is that A alpha perp is some kind of projection tensor, I'll call it omega, omega alpha beta, multiplying the original vector. And the purpose of omega is precisely to kill the two components along K and N, and what survives are the purely transverse components. And that projection operator, well, it's what I had in brackets before, by definition, it's G alpha beta plus K alpha N beta plus N alpha K beta, and that's the transverse projector. So a bit more complicated than P, because with P we only had to worry about one space-time direction. Here we have to worry about two null space-time directions. But, you know, given our choice for N, then we have a projection operator that kills everything that's not along N and K, and therefore defines the transverse directions for us. You had a question?
Necessarily that transverse is purely spatial.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because I've killed two null directions, what remains must be space-like. Yeah. All right. And just to close this off, I'll just give you a couple of properties for this thing. I won't prove this because I think you can do it. If you multiply two of those projection operators together, as for any projection operation, it doesn't matter if you do it more than once, you get the same projection back. So the product of those two things is one of those things. And in addition to that, we have the property that the trace of this is not 3, but 2. So the trace of this is 4. Trace of this is minus 1, minus 1. That gives us an overall 2. And that's going to be our tool. So that's how we decompose a vector. That was the easy thing to do. But that's going to be our tool to introduce a projection of more complicated things like tensors. And eventually we'll end up with a full decomposition of the velocity gradient or the gradient of the vector field K. And that will give us the key to understand how those geodesics are flying apart. And that will give us, you know, all of those quantities that we've introduced before, like expansion, shear, not rotation, because here we have hypersurface orthogonality. So we're going to find that the rotation tensor automatically vanishes. But basically, with those tools that we've just introduced, and especially the the choice of that n vector, we're going to have a very nice way of proceeding with the rest of the discussion in pretty systematic ways. But the key ideas are very important behind this. It's important, I think, to understand what we just accomplished here, which is quite a bit, still in the context of that example, but now we'll be able to do this in much more general terms starting next week. All right, so I think that's enough for today. Any questions before we quit? All good? Okay, very good. So I'll see you next week.